When a German manufacturer named Benz decided to name his new car after his daughter, Mercedes, he made her name famous and somewhat synonymous for quality and for excellence. In 1790, when the Congress of the United States of America chose to cut out a new city, a district, and name it as the capital of the country after the general of the army and the first president of the republic, Washington, they guaranteed that forever into the history of this country, the name of that city and that man would be well known and well spoken. Some who are here this morning also were named after other people. You had, or your parents had, a favorite relative or friend, and so you were named after Grandma Marie or Uncle Al because they especially liked that person or owed that person a significant amount of money or whatever the reason was, and you got the name that you got. Now, when Jesus was teaching his disciples how to pray, he taught them to honor God the Father by praying, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name." Names had a significance in ancient days different from the significance that we give to names today. It was believed in those days that a person's name and the person were the same. So, for example, there's an Old Testament character named Naomi, and her name means pleasant, but her life wasn't. She faced famine, unemployment, moved to a foreign country, was widowed. Her two sons, her only children, both died. And she said, "My name doesn't fit who I am." So she changed her name to Mara, which means bitter. Or Jesus had among his followers a man whom one day he stopped calling Simon and started calling the Rock, Peter. And it stuck because that name fit who he was. In America, if we first meet someone, we tend to say, "What's your name?" Because we kind of assume that the person and the name are different from one another, not necessarily totally connected, at least not exactly the same. Whereas in ancient days, it would probably be more likely that the person would say, "Who are you?" Because it was assumed that the person and the name were the same. Now, there are some of us here this morning who have uncommon names, and as a result of that, we understand better how those ancients understood it and saw it. So, for example, if your name is Bob or Bill or Jane or Joan, then you probably don't think of your name as exclusively yours. From kindergarten or before, you knew someone else who had your name, so you said your name to somebody else. Or when the teacher would call the roll, or even at a family gathering, you might have had a cousin that had the exact same name as you. So your name and you aren't the same because it's shared with someone else. Now, there are a few of us here who have unusual names, like Leith, who tend to think that a name is like private property. I mean, nobody else can have my name. In fact, the chances are very good that you don't know anyone else named Leith because there aren't very many around. I don't even need a last name. I mean, I have no particular use for it. I mean, I'm the only one who has my name. So Leith and I are the same. Only once in my life have I ever met another person named Leith. And it was when I was a college student. It was a long time ago. I've tried to pretty much erase the memory. And you know, I mean, even now, after all these years, to this day, I have trouble understanding how that person's parents could give my name to her. Now, since there is only one God, his name is not to be shared. I mean, God thinks of his name as his and his alone. We don't name our children God. You've never met a God Jones or a God Smith. I mean, that's not only sacrilegious in sound, but it's stupid. It doesn't make sense. No one else can be God. God God and God alone is God. There is only one God. God and his name are the same. So that when we speak the name God, we do not distinguish between the person and the name. Now, although the name may be the same, the treatment is not always the same. For people often treat God as if he were not God. And many say God's name in a very ungodly fashion. It's interesting to me to listen in the media and just in conversations around me how frequently the expression, "Oh my God," has come into our everyday conversations and vocabulary. People say it regularly. So someone wins the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes, or scratches a bumper on another car, or sees a friend that you haven't seen for 45 minutes, and the next thing the person says is, "Oh my God." And it's not even thought about. I'm sure that many of the people who regularly say that have no idea, in fact, what they have said. Because to a large extent, God in many people's lives today has been trivialized. He's not important. He's sort of ignored. It isn't even quite the same as being dishonored. It's as if he's not there. He doesn't matter. Or if he's there, it just has no consequence or doesn't make any difference. I mean, I think back, read back, as recently as 25 or 30 years ago, and there are all kinds of debates going on about whether God exists, and there's a big deal out of atheism, and atheists were on talk shows. I don't hear much of that anymore. I don't hear people worried about it or arguing about it because God doesn't seem important enough to worry. And people sort of take for granted he's there. God's sort of like a $2 bill. I mean, we know they exist, and every now and then you might run into one, but you quick get rid of it because you might confuse it with a $1 bill. But it hardly makes any difference at all in life. It's just not important. And so for many people, God and his name just aren't important. They don't mean to swear by what they say. It's just that it doesn't matter. It wasn't that way for those ancient Jews in the Bible. God was very important. They perceived that God made a great deal of difference in every issue of life. So no matter what you're talking about, what you wear, what you eat, what you say, the way you look, who you're related to, everything was dealing with God. God was part and parcel of all of life, every detail. And they considered God's name so holy, they held him in such awe that they wouldn't even say his name. Have you read in the Bible or elsewhere, or maybe seen on a TV screen or a movie screen, that the name Jehovah or Yahweh is the name for God, kind of pronounced different ways? Do you know that that's because we don't know how to pronounce it? Because the Jews for hundreds of years wouldn't say it. Not one of them ever said the word. So we have no idea what the correct pronunciation is. They considered God and his name so special that you couldn't say his name the way you would say anyone else's name. Now compare that to us. We're Christians. And as Christians, we claim the name of God. We say, God is our Father. And as our Father, we have a great deal of concern about what he thinks of us and what others think of him. We care about the reputation, to use Jesus' words, of our Abba, our Daddy, who is up in heaven. And we care about how his name is used. It's a story about a group of teenage boys who were hanging out one night, rather bored. And one of them came up with a suggestion that they do something that was not only dangerous, but illegal. And peer pressure had its flow, and everybody agreed, sure, let's do it. Who cares if we get caught? We'll probably get away with it anyway. We'll be safe. Except for one guy in the group, and he was reluctant, reticent to participate. And so, as peer pressure often goes, there was some taunting. And the others tried to get him to participate in what they were proposing. And one of them said, "What's the matter? Are you afraid that your dad will hurt you?" Teenager said back, "No. I'm afraid I'll hurt my dad." See, he was concerned. As we as Christians are concerned, not so much that God will hurt us, our daddy in heaven will hurt us, but we are concerned in what we say and what we do, lest we hurt him. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. That's not much a part of our vocabulary, is it? Hallowed. The closest we ever come to that word is on the 31st of October every year, when the trick-or-treaters come out and we carve the pumpkins, and we call that day Halloween. But probably there isn't 1% of the people who are in this room who have any idea what Halloween means, because it's not something that we think much about. It's just sort of there. Actually, there's a history to it. You see, in ancient times, there was this day on the calendar that was celebrated by everybody as a holiday, and it's the 1st of November, and it's Hallows Day. And the evening before it is Hallows Eve, or Hallows Evening before it, except people said it so fast and said it so often that eventually they put it together into a single word, and it became Halloween, and it was the night before the day that celebrated the Hallows, which was the holy people, or the saints. And they had a special day that was on the calendar that would remember those special kind of people. So hallowed means holy. Hallowed be your name is holy be your name. And you say, great, well, I really appreciate that. I didn't know that before. But I don't know what holy means either. So that isn't really very helpful to me. Well, holy means different. That's really what it means. Except it means different good. So, for example, a holy place is a place that is different from other places, but it's a good kind of different. And a holy person is somebody who's different from everybody else, but a good kind of different. Or we talk about holy days when we sort of slur that into holidays. And that's a day that's different from all the other days around it on the calendar, but it's a good kind of different. And so hallowed means that which is different, and God and God's name are to be hallowed, different from anybody else's name, but a good kind of different. Yeah, well, but we still need more of a modern term to really grasp what this is about. I think in today's terms we might say that it means sacred or special or central. That's it, central, in the middle, number one. Picture your life as something you could draw on a piece of paper. I've actually had classes and support groups and things like that where they do this. They give you a piece of paper. If they're really into it, they give you a piece of newsprint they put up on the wall and a bunch of magic markers or different colored pencils, and they tell you to draw your life. I can't be the only person here that's done that. You've got to have done it too. And you look at that piece of paper, first of all, they tell you like you've got a half an hour to do it. And you think, I got to get out of here. And so then you start scribbling some things down, and you see other people drawing some things, and you think to yourself, I don't know if I'm going to do this or not. But then you kind of get into it, and you discover there's all kinds of things you can put on the page. You can draw a line, sort of like a timeline, and you can say where you've been. That sort of identifies who you are. Or you can start putting on there what your relationships are. So you put down that you have parents and you have children that have been through a marriage or a divorce or you're a widow. Or you're planning a marriage, you're engaged. Or you've never had that kind of a relationship and you would like to or not like to. And then beyond the relationships, you start thinking about things, stuff that you have. And so you draw a little picture of your car and you have another picture of the apartment building or the house where you live. Picture of your bank with some dollar signs in there, and over here a few notes of loans that you have. And all the things that have to do with money. And then you start watching your watch and you think, hey, I'm never going to get this done in a half an hour because what about my hobbies? They're very important to me as well. So I go skiing and I work out or I collect stamps or coins or kind of into old cars or traveling. And so I start putting all these things there and using red pens and blue and green and having some dark colors and some light colors because there are parts of life that are darker than others and other parts of life that are brighter than others. And then there are some things that are so private that you use symbols that nobody else would ever be able to figure out because you wouldn't want this paper to get into the wrong hands. And then there's some things that are so painful you can't even put them down, but you can see them even on a blank page. Now imagine with me that you took a piece of paper and you drew your life. Can you see it? Question. What's in the middle? what is at the center of the page. You see, some people's lives revolve completely around a relationship. So they have a husband or a wife or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, maybe even someone that they don't get along with very well, and everything relates to that person. There are others who in the middle have an addiction, and all the money, job, relationships, everything ties into that addiction. For somebody else, it's employment. You know those people, maybe you, where everything is in terms of the career, the workplace. The issue isn't how much is paid, the issue isn't family, the issue isn't anything else. It's always the job, central. There's some people, I talked to a fellow this past week who was talking about a mutual friend. There's a guy who's, I don't know, fairly well known in certain circles, who's very well to do by almost anybody's standard. And he was described in an interesting way. He said, in the middle of his life, central to everything that he's about, is a black hole. He's empty in the middle. He's all these things, and they all revolve around nothing. Those who pray, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name," are praying that God will be in the middle. That he will be central to everything and all of life. God in his name, different, hallowed, sacred, special, whatever word you want to use, that God is number one. But there's something very important to know here. And that is that it is God who puts himself at the middle of our lives, in the middle of the page, and not us because we choose to put him there. It is not totally up to us. It is ultimately God's decision. And that is why Jesus framed it as a petition, as a request. Our Father in heaven, please, may your name be central, hallowed in my life. Last month, when the coup took place to overthrow Mikhail Gorbachev as the president of the Soviet Union, there were those in Moscow who sought to take the man who legally was the president of that country and keep him under house arrest in the Crimea. And Boris Yeltsin at the Russian parliament and tens of thousands of Muscovites insisted that these new leaders wouldn't take over and that Gorbachev be brought back. There was some question whether he wanted to come back. And so they had to ask him, "Are you willing to come back and be the president?" What they were doing was asking the man who was the president to be the president. Or take the case of a couple that has split up, still legally married, maybe or maybe not, suing for divorce, and they're living in separate quarters, and there's an attempt by the man to reconcile the relationship, and he goes over to where the woman is staying, knocks on the door, and says, "I want you to come home and be my wife." And if you're an objective observer, you say, "Hey, she's already your wife. I mean, you're legally married. She's your wife. Hey, but you know what that means. I want my wife to be my wife." Or do you remember the story that Jesus used of the prodigal son? This young man who took his father's money and left his father's home and lived this wild, profligate life. And it was just disaster. I mean, it just devastated him. Spent all the money. And at last he comes home and talks to his father. And his father was still, I mean, legally, technically his father. But he came back home and said, "I want to be your son. I want you to be my father." It's saying, let the president be the president. Let the wife be the wife. Let the Father be the Father. Let God be God in my life. That's what hallowed be your name means. God, of course, legally is God. I mean, we can't change that. He is the supreme commander, the owner of the universe and all that is contained in the universe. But because he has that position legally does not mean that we call upon him to have that relationship in the middle of all that we are about. Let God be God, our Father in heaven, be central in my life. I've learned some lately about wills and trusts and powers of attorney, and while I don't know anywhere near as much as some of you do, I find that it's a fascinating part of our American legal system. For example, You can have a trust drawn up. It's a legal entity. It's established with some pieces of paper. And you can put into that trust everything you own. So your bank accounts, your car, your beagle, whatever you own can go into that trust. And then a trustee is named. The way a lot of these work, you become the trustee for your own trust, at least initially, but someone else can be named to succeed you or can be the trustee right away. And then that person has complete control over all your possessions that are in the trust. There are a couple types. There's a revocable trust, that means you can change your mind, get out of it, or there's an irrevocable trust. Once that's done, it's finished. Now, there's another legal thing that's called a power of attorney. In that case, you authorize someone else to be able to represent you, to enter contracts, to be able to buy things and sell things. It's almost as if that person can sign your name in your place. And then there's another interesting, much newer thing that's come along, and that's called a living will. In that case, you sign a piece of paper that says if you're incapacitated and a decision has to be made on whether medical care will continue or be withdrawn, that this other person or persons can make that decision on your behalf. One day I got thinking about all these things. They're pretty powerful matters. I decided before you ever sign on the line for any of those, you better think about it for a while because they're very important. And then I decided, if you're ever going to do that, make sure that the person that you name is somebody you really trust. If you're going to turn over everything you have, the power to sign your name, and life and death to somebody else, you better pick the right person. That led me to think of still another thought. And that is, naming somebody doesn't mean they'll do it. So I might have all these drawn up by a lawyer, and I might put you down as the person who is the trustee of all my possessions, and I may give you power of attorney, and I may decide that you're the one who can determine whether I live or die. That doesn't mean you want to do it. You've got to agree to do it, right? So just my decision, I've got to ask you. And then you've got to say yes, or you've got to say no. When we pray, hallowed be your name, we are signing everything over to God. We're making him the center of life. Think about that before you do it, because it has got to be the most monumental decision that you can ever make in all of life. And before you do it, make sure you trust him. Because there's no point in doing this with a God that you don't think that you can trust. Understand that when he becomes the Lord of life central, when his name is hallowed in your life or mine, that's irrevocable. There's no going back. Once it's done, it's done. But also understand that our choosing doesn't necessarily mean he'll do it. So we ask him. It's not just our decision to draw our little map of our lives and put God in the middle. It's a request. Our Father in heaven, please be central. May your life be holy in my life. What do you think? Do you think you can trust God that much? Are you ready to invite him to be the center of all that is your life? Because if the answer is yes, then you can pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name in me. Let's stand and pray together. Dear God, there is no doubt that you are God. And as God, you can listen in on the thoughts of our mind, and you know the emotions of our hearts. And so you know the response of every single one of us here this morning to the invitation from Jesus to pray this stunning prayer. Lord, I pray that the prayer of Jesus will be the prayer of our hearts and our lives, and that your answer will be a forever yes. when we pray to you, our Father in heaven. Central, hallowed be your name in us. For Jesus' sake.
Bill and Barb Lamer come to share their faith story of how God has met them at the point of need in their life.
It was the summer of 83, July to be exact, when my older brother Doug drove his family up from Louisiana to visit our family in Buffalo, Minnesota. Before their short visit came to an end, Doug took me aside and asked me if I really knew Jesus personally. Taken back by his question, I defensively replied, "Sure I do. I've been going to church all of my life." 2 months later, in September, Steve, my first husband, unexpectedly asked for a divorce. He moved out of the house that same week. Entering the new year, 84, I was devastated. With two young children, one dog, five cats, two horses, a house with 10 acres, and a full-time job 50 minutes into the cities, I began repeatedly asking myself, crying out, if I really did know Jesus. Does he love me? Would he forgive me of my sins? Then, crying myself to sleep one cold January evening, I stopped crying long enough to ask Jesus into my heart. My new life began at 33.
I accepted God when I was in high school, but I drifted for several years, and unfortunately, it took a divorce for God to get my attention. About a year after our divorces, Barb and I met and started to date. Then 5 years ago, after counseling with a care pastor, we were married. We both had two boys, ages 6 and 10. As we started to work on blending our family, we ran into many difficulties, such as custody battles, rebellion, and rejection by some of our sons. Although we had difficulties, we had much joy as well, and we learned to rely on God for our strengths.
2 years into our new marriage, Chad, my oldest son, then 12, angrily demanded that he go live with his father and new family in South Central Minnesota. In Chad's eyes, Bill and I could do no right, causing daily turmoil in our new family. After good counsel with Ken Travilla, much heartache, prayer, and Psalm 37:5, which reads, "Commit your way to the Lord, trust also in him, and he will help you," we decided to let Chad go. What happened when we let Chad go? God allowed Chad to be in our lives every other weekend for 3 years, which meant an 8-hour driving commitment on our parts to make it happen. God took that drive time and turned it into a 4-hour quiet time between him and I, and better yet, gave Chad and I 4 hours of uninterrupted talk time, truly a blessing in disguise. We reconciled our relationship only to build a cherishable and healthy relationship. God continued to bless us by placing the Broies into Chad's life, a Christian friend and family that keeps an open-door policy for him. Another new chapter unfolds in our lives now as Chad and his father's family recently moved to Grand Rapids, Minnesota. We will continue to hold Chad up in prayer daily, so we claim God's promise of Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. That's his purpose, not ours.
Shortly after Chad left, my oldest son decided to go and live with his mother, where he was given total freedom to come and go and do as he pleased. At that time, he did not want to be a part of our lives and would not allow us to be a part of his. Then late one night, about a year and a half later, I received a phone call from him. He was at a gas station and asked me to come and pick him up because he could no longer go back to his mother's home. I said fine, but then called his mother to find out what was going on. She informed me that she could no longer control him and did not want him back at her house. Barb and I were then faced with an angry, suicidal young man that didn't want to live at our home. We were not sure how to handle all the problems facing my son and our family, so we turned to God. We asked God to guide and direct us and to take control of my son's life. We had the prayer support of our Sunday school class, the Living Word, and many close friends. God led us to a Christian counselor, and by using tough love and putting boundaries back in place, my son soon responded. But 10 months later, he decided to go back and live with his mother. Although we disagreed with that decision, we have peace with it, knowing that God's hand is at work. Blending a family is never easy. We've encountered many difficulties and trials, but we've had great joy along the way. We've been blessed by caring people like Bob and Connie Troutman, who 4 years ago incorporated us into a small group Bible study and equipped us to handle our difficulties to grow spiritually. We also have had the joy of seeing many of our prayers answered and have learned to focus on God and not our troubles. Today we lead a small group Bible study of our own and are reaching out to help others that are facing the difficulties we've been through. We believe that without God's help, we would never have been able to blend our families, and we thank God daily for all that he's done in our lives.